I think people are coming to terms now after the last 24 months that jobs are not inherently stable. Layoffs all over the place. And so now it's interesting, you're seeing sort of the opposite thing happening, especially in the Gen Z population, where folks are like, well, if I could get fired, then I'm not going to try and risk then getting laid off. I have this conversation a lot with young reps and people looking for career advice. My advice is always, trying really hard obviously won't guarantee you success, but not trying hard will guarantee that you're not going to be successful. Right. We're lucky enough at Owner, we've got some brand equity, and I have a hyper transparent hiring style. Here's what we're about. Here's the good things, awesome product, super smart people, but here are the things that aren't for everybody.
Yeah.
It's like, hey, we're not a work-life balance culture. Like, we're here to win. We're trying to build a winning company, and that means working really hard.
Yep.
And that's not for everybody, and absolutely no shade. If you want to go find a 35 a week thing and you got other personal interests, that's awesome and I'm happy for you, but like, that's not us. We expect really hard work. And
it's important to communicate that, you know, because I think a lot of companies pussyfoot around this issue.
Yeah.
And they're like delicate about it.
Or they do the opposite.
Yeah.
They're like, oh yeah, we have great work-life balance. And then you get in and they're like, well, I didn't see your green dot on it at 5:15. And you're like, well, I thought we had work-life balance. you see this all the time. And it's fine to work 9 to 5. There is nothing wrong with it. It's just you have to be honest with yourself and honest as a company, then like, we might not achieve a certain type of outcome. Any massive profits are somebody else's opportunity, and those profits will be competed away. And if you're working 4 days a week and my team is working 5.5 days a week, like, I'm gonna win. Or like, that, I'll bet on the 5.5 day a week company every day.
Founded in 2017, Startwell is Toronto's independent hub for innovators to collaborate. Our podcasts relate perspectives from the world's most diverse urban population to reflect unique insights into global business, media, and culture.
Hey, Kyle.
How you doing? Thanks for having me.
It's a pleasure to have you here in studio, man.
Yeah, it's fun. Great spot, too.
Thank you. Thanks very much. You've been here before.
A couple times, yeah. We loved coming here when I was at Shopify. This was like a go-to co-working for us.
Yeah, it was nice because it was also a time, right? Like this, like coming out of the pandemic question of what's where and what's allowed and who's doing what. And I think we were talking off camera, this idea of like, you know, Shopify senior executives liked the fact we're down the road from the office.
Mm-hmm.
The office that wasn't an office but was about to be...
Yeah.
What? I don't know.
A port.
A port. That's what they called it.
Uh-huh.
Ports and portals.
Yeah. A port where you could come do meetings and hang out, but we hadn't gotten there yet. So the offices were just closed, but a bunch of us needed to spend time together to figure a lot of stuff out. So this was our spot.
Yeah. And that's what we do every day, man. You know, it's like whether it's offsites that have programming or just people that need to jam on stuff. So it was cool. Cool to have had you here back then.
Yeah.
Wearing a different hat, or wearing a hat.
Yeah.
That had a logo on it that had Shopify written on it. Okay, but now you're an entrepreneur. CRO.
I didn't found the company, but helping entrepreneurs building a business. Yeah.
So, okay, let's talk about Owner and the story of Owner before you got to Owner.
Mm-hmm. So it's an interesting one. So, company was founded by a guy named Adam Guild. So he was 18, 19 years old at the time.
Yeah.
Wow. Typical Silicon Valley story. So he dropped out of high school at 14 years old because he ran at the time the second biggest Minecraft server in the world. Mm-hmm. And then started a mobile game studio, built that up. He was a Teal fellow. And at some point had an epiphany that games weren't helpful and he wanted to do something more impactful. Okay. And around the time, his mom, who had started a dog grooming business, was losing money hand over fist. And they were worried about like losing the house because she had personally guaranteed the loan to start the dog grooming shop. And it was like a pretty dark time. And he will say... his mom turned to her nerdy 16-year-old son who knew computer stuff.
Right.
And so he decided to take his digital marketing skills from building and scaling mobile games and figure out how to do that with a brick and mortar local business. And then, you know, didn't take him very long. That business got back on track. She's busier than ever. Super successful now. It's one of the most successful dog grooming shops in Beverly Hills.
Oh, I think
they're opening a second location. Yeah, it's a really cool story. And that was his breakthrough.
There's these details in this whole story that are very kind of interesting.
Mm-hmm. This is the sort of founder market fit, founder earned secret thing that makes him such an interesting fit to run this business.
Sure.
And so he decided games are wasting kids' time.
Yeah.
Keep in mind, this is him at like 17 years old, and he has this epiphany. Games are wasting kids' time, and I have this opportunity to help small business people. Why don't I go do this? Dog grooming studios are a small market. What's the biggest market? Restaurants.
Mm-hmm.
And so then decided he was going to build the tooling that he built for his mom, but for businesses at scale, restaurants at scale.
Okay.
And then started cold calling and hustling little tiny restaurants in the neighborhood.
This is what neighborhood? Beverly Hills?
In LA.
Okay.
He wasn't in Beverly Hills.
It's like on Crenshaw. He's like, I'm going to walk all the way up there.
Yeah, exactly.
Give me some money.
No, he didn't come from the Beverly Hills background. He will attest to. So originally the focus was building that digital marketing presence for sit down restaurants.
Okay.
So they built that business to about $1 million in ARR. Pandemic hit. That million in ARR went to zero basically overnight.
Right.
Because it was a variable usage based pricing. And then he and his co-founder Dean, our CTO, pivoted the business within a matter of weeks and said, okay, what do these businesses need now?
Mm-hmm.
Everybody was trying to figure out takeout and delivery. Most of these businesses getting hosed by Uber Eats and DoorDash to the tune of the 30% commission.
Right, right.
And so they built an online ordering platform in 5 weeks, deployed it, and then went from $1 million to zero in a course of 5 weeks.
Yeah.
And then zero to $1 million again within the next 6 months or so.
Same customer base, or like this is now
slightly different customer base.
Okay.
Instead of sit down sort of dine in restaurants,
right?
Now the focus was takeout and delivery centric.
But it
concepts.
Wasn't those sit downs trying to like make up new games.
It was originally.
Okay.
And then as they
and then it took on for anyone doing takeoff.
Yeah. And then it, wow. as the product got takeout. Definition, then it was, okay, we're going to go after, you know, it's pizza places, Chinese food, Indian, anything that travels well in a box and people like to eat at home.
Mm-hmm.
And so then, so that was through 2021. I joined in June 22, and we were about $3 million in revenue. They'd raised the Series A at the end of 2021. A ZERP round, big valuation.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously, like, you know, the Teal Fellow high school dropout thing, venture
yeah.
is just dying to
the stuff. Biodata release, yeah, sold the capacity on this one.
Yeah. And so that was 2 years ago, last week. And we've gone from 3 to 25 ARR in the last 2 years. The team has scaled.
How many people are on the team now?
Close to 130.
Okay.
Yeah.
All over the world or Canada, US?
Yeah. So we only serve the US market. The team is broadly distributed. So my team spans Canada, US, all through Latin America. About, I would say 60% of my team is LATAM based.
Oh, cool.
Because I own support, CS, our customer onboarding function, which are largely LATAM based. And it's been a massive competitive advantage for us.
Mm-hmm.
I have people in Barcelona and wherever we can find incredible talent that wants to work roughly on North American hours.
Yeah, that's the thing.
And we make the remote thing work.
Nice.
Yeah.
Do you have offices?
No. Okay. Well, technically we have a logistics office in the Bay Area.
Okay.
But no physical offices for employees to go into.
Wow. Mm-hmm. Remote first.
Still remote first.
And is that something that would change or is that like a cultural value?
We're pretty committed to it. Who knows? And that could vary by function.
Right.
I am a big believer in remote in remote first because it allows you to go attract like the very best of the best talent. Mm-hmm. So one of the staff design folks that Adam hired, we were talking about Shopify, was actually like Toby's like head design partner and worked, you know, directly with Toby for a number of years.
Wow.
So to be able to go get that person and then at the same time an engineer who's done very similar work at HubSpot or Facebook, you know, we hired a guy from the Instagram team who did just like incredible work, who came and built our entire app. And so to pluck like the very best of the best of those functions, I think remote is an incredible advantage.
Right.
But most companies do it really poorly. You know, they just transpose what they did in an office and they try to do that online as opposed to sort of reinventing from first principles. Like, okay, what does work look like? Mm-hmm. How do you take advantage of the trade-offs of remote and not try to recreate the things that remote is like not great at?
Right.
Like the social stuff. Like we just don't try to
socialize. Like, smarmily. Yeah. You're not sending out like drink cocktail kits to everybody all over the world and saying, hey, at this time zone, I know it's the morning, don't eat your breakfast. We're going to make cocktails.
Yeah, exactly. And it, because you can try to hamstring, you can try to just jam those things into a remote environment to try to get that social connectivity. But, you know, you'll use, 3 hours of potential work time and get like a minuscule improvement.
But then, I mean, I've seen this with a bunch of people we talked to about engineering teams specifically, mm-hmm. right? I think it's different at different, with different roles in organizations, especially if people are in direct relationship with customers, then their stickiness changes in terms of how they feel they belong and all this sort of stuff. Mm-hmm. But with engineers and especially like 10Xers and these like, you know, high output characters, they almost become like mercenaries. And is that something that's like worrisome with the remote model, that like as easily as it was to attract, you know, once the problem that they're hung up on is fixed, they're going to go off to solve a different problem at a different company?
So very potentially, and I think this is why a lot of companies abandon remote pretty quickly. But if you study, so what is retention a function of? It's a function of engagement. Mm-hmm. And if you look at all the engagement research, and so the stuff I really like is by Gallup. It's this study called the Q12. Okay. So it's the top 12 questions that determine how engaged an employee is or isn't. Mm. And out of all of the 12 items in there, only one or two really have anything to do with like personal connectivity. One of them is, do I have a best friend at work? Huh. Going to be much harder to recreate remote.
Yeah.
But that's one of those 12. What those 12 criteria are really made up of is, do I have the tools to be successful at my job? Am I learning new skills? Do I feel like I can trust my direct manager and the leadership team? Do I feel connected to the mission? Mm-hmm. And a bunch of these things have no advantage or disadvantage being remote.
Yeah.
But you have to be thoughtful about it. So like every single week we bring in a customer to talk to the whole engineering team, and they ask questions, they get feedback. We feature customers at all hands calls a lot. Our exec team spends a lot of time in front of customers, and we tell a lot of customer stories to help everybody feel connected to the mission. Because it's, you know, we have a mission people can feel great about, entrepreneurs, small business, restaurants. And so leaning into that is important. And none of that, in my opinion, requires being in an office.
It's almost easier remote in some cases, I would think. The idea of like,
for a lot of it,
right? Communicating the common updates or the company updates and these like customer stories and stuff is a lot easier when you have people's attention. And mm-hmm. sometimes I think that is the kind of pinnacle piece here when everyone's remote. You know, in person, it's easy to have distractions when you're trying to get that attention. And doing like an all hands for 130 people to give them a 5-minute update is problematic anyway.
Yeah.
You know?
And going back to the sort of Shopify stuff, so I come from a sales background. So my whole career, I've been in a sales bullpen.
Okay.
And I've managed like with reaching out to people physically, like within my proximity. We used to run daily stand-ups and get everybody rallied and talk about what's important and what we're focused on training and development wise. And so we went into this remote environment and I was, you know, at the first, everybody's like, oh, this is going to be a weird couple weeks.
Right. Right.
And then pretty Shopify was so far ahead on this pretty quickly. They're like, hey, by the way, this is probably a months, not weeks thing.
Right.
And I started to go, oh no.
What am I going to do?
Because it was already uncomfortable to manage remote. I just didn't know. Like I had no sense for what was happening in the business right now. And so I had to, after about my third week working remote, I spent almost an entire week doing nothing but reading about how to manage remote environments. Mm. And there's so much incredible content out there.
I think so. And yeah, like where were you sourcing that content from in those early days?
Well, there's lots of great remote companies that always existed. So Matt Mullenweg, who CEO of Automattic, was probably the number one resource. He's got a podcast called Distributed. He's written a book. There's lots of stuff that he's got. But GitLab has open sourced all of their remote work stuff.
Okay.
Envision at the time was remote
Envision,
first.
Envision, what happened to them, poor guys, eh?
I know.
I was just having a conversation with someone about this. They were like studying UI, UX, and I gave them the whole spiel on like testing interfaces for mobile apps and like what platforms were the ones to use. And then I was like, oh yeah, that one, I don't know if it's still around.
Yeah. Yeah. That is called getting outcompeted.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
But at the same time, it's weird. I don't know. Like I just had a chat with Vitaly for the podcast from Stack It Out yesterday or day before.
Mm-hmm.
And we were talking about this idea of like scale startups, especially SaaS, and the global mindset. And the idea that like if you don't build capacity, it's a difficult thing to do, but build capacity into your expansion function, whatever that is in your organization, you won't see the real opportunity for your company because your company, it's very difficult today. I mean, it's always been the case for 20 years now that like a SaaS company should be locked into a language and a geo. You know, and especially now with remote work, if your team is distributed, the question becomes, how do you leverage that distribution to get access to market in the local territories that those workers that belong to your team are in? Because they have critical insight into like the Bolivian, you know, opportunity mining, right? You know, for your software. So and that's a whole nother kind of way of thinking about this stuff.
Yeah.
Which is fascinating to me.
I mean, I think I say this a lot about revenue leaders, and I think you can say this more generally. The strength of a great revenue leader is be able to operate at two levels of abstraction simultaneously. And most good leaders can do one of those two pretty well, and they'll get stuck in one mode and forget about the other. But the great leaders who build great companies have the ability to do those two things simultaneously. One is live in the real details of your business and really understand how this machine works at a very fine grain so that you're constantly able to tweak and push and prod and give your frontline managers and your second line leaders direction with a level of insight that they might not be able to have yet. And,
right.
But you really have to know the mechanics of how the business works and
Absolutely.
The conversion rate, every little thing. But then you also need to be able to live at a quarters and years out level where you're planning, okay, what does this business need to look like in 12 months? Because for us, we're trying to go 25 to 100 now in the next 24 months. And to maintain that velocity, we can't just do the same things that got us here.
Yeah.
So you need to start placing bets. And as the number goes from 25 to 100 million, the time horizon of the bets you're placing and the size of the bet means that you got to think like pretty far in advance.
Right. Right.
So
like deals, enterprise deals don't close quick. Is that
what we're talking? Or channels.
Right.
So for us, partnerships is an example.
Yeah.
So, in order to think about, you know, maintaining a hyperscale growth rate, okay. Performance marketing works awesome. Outbound works awesome.
Does it work awesome anymore?
For us, it does.
Okay.
Yeah.
Tell us all how.
I have a whole Saster talk on it if people want
to
go
that. Yeah, we'll link to that in the episode.
Yeah. And it's just about like data and infrastructure systems and that fine-grained granularity.
Mm-hmm.
But no, like me knowing where we need to go in 2 years makes me understand, okay, like I need to place new channel bets. And so a partner is a distribution channel that works like well in our market. So we've been working on this since Q3 of last year, mm-hmm. and we're going live with like a massive national partnership in the next, you know, like 2 weeks that has the chance to represent a quarter or more of our net new revenue in 2025.
That's pretty big from a new channel, mm-hmm. that expectation. And this is a digital marketing channel. Like so this is a place to put your ads.
This is a food distributor that has thousands of food reps
right.
on the streets, knocking on doors, delivering crates of food.
So see, like, what would you say for our audience that maybe comes from software and is considering this? I find it really interesting how, like, the expectation of performance marketing, like advertising, paid advertising,
yeah,
is almost discommensurate with what you can expect from it. I forget who it was. It might have been that same conversation that I had 2 days ago. Which is interesting because they're like, you know, an ad platform, right?
Yeah.
But like, I think he was saying that like companies shouldn't expect more than 20% of their like marketing spend to be on ads.
Yeah. It depends.
Everyone always, this was the holy grail, right? In the last decade was that.
Yeah.
Awesome. You pay, like someone's searching for something.
Yeah.
You can connect with the fact that they're already warm because they're looking for it. And then it's just about conversion optimization on your side of your website or whatever, right? Yeah. And that was the holy grail. And the promise was that you could have calculable advertising, but it's kind of
cheap,
but it's bullshit, you know, like otherwise everyone would just keep reinvesting and go get $1 billion to just put into this machine.
Yeah. Like anything, there's only an arbitrage opportunity in some place for a certain amount of time before it's competed away. And so for us at Owner, 90% of our inbound volume comes from, I call it 80% comes from Meta and Google. And I have a demand gen leader who rips, is just churning out incredible content, has it down to a system, and it's great for us. That can't be the only thing we do. And going back pre-Shopify to League, at some point we just turned all of that off.
Interesting.
We were spending a bunch of money on it, but nobody's looking for healthcare operating system for my employees.
No, that's the thing. Like it's the procurement function is totally outside of like how to reach those people.
And that was a challenger product as well. That wasn't a product that people knew was an option. So
is League still around?
Yeah.
Okay. This is a telemedicine platform, or what is League? Or what was League?
So they call it a healthcare operating system. So it's a benefits administration plus a care navigation healthcare access platform. So you have an app that tells you your benefits. But now they've pivoted to doing these like platform deals selling to insurance providers.
Okay.
It's quite a bit different now. But we turned off all of the performance marketing, like tens of thousands of dollars a month, and we put it to zero and put all of our efforts into ABM. So I think
ABM for newbies?
Account-based marketing. Okay. So hyper-targeted marketing to very specific accounts and just like swarming the account.
Mm-hmm.
So touches through direct mail and emails from the CEO, our CEO to their CHRO, and then a handwritten note and dinner, like a dinner series all over the US. So like a very...
Right. You want to be in front of them at every opportunity, but not in a spammy way. It's like you're always offering value and making them feel part of a story.
Yeah. Because the deal size was hundreds of thousands or millions of dollars.
Right.
So to get in front of an executive, like a real executive in our target market, you would have gladly paid $5,000 for that, $10,000 for that.
It's super,
I can't do that at Owner.
Yeah.
You know, the CAC has to be quite different there, but.
It's super interesting. Cause like, I mean, what we find that even with my business, right? Is that like, and especially more so post pandemic as people have digital fatigue and a lot of mistrust because they're getting a lot of, you know, I don't know, rando messages about duck cleaning, you know, and Nigerian finance opportunities. And everything else, like even if you talk to some people from some of the major banks recently about fraud, and it's like the amazing rampantness of fraud in Canada, check fraud and like all of these. So I think level of mistrust for new relationship formation is very high.
Mm-hmm.
But if your inroad is experiential, it changes the whole narrative.
Yeah.
You know, if it's not transactional, I guess is the point.
Yeah. And more companies are going to have to shift to a near-bound strategy and understanding how do you leverage your customers and their networks and, mm-hmm. and get warm introductions. And there's, you know, we're going through every couple of years, there's a transformation needed in pipeline generation, demand gen or sales outbound, whatever it might be. Mm-hmm. And we're definitely in that now. The inbox is basically torched with Gen AI. Yeah. We're at deliverability rates and open rates are plummeting massively. And so companies have to figure out new ways. And
even if you get high open rates, you're getting really poor conversions, I find. Mm-hmm. Like we on our subscriber list for Starwell, we have 35,000 people on our list, right? But everyone's a lurker.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like I know you guys are watching and listening, okay. And everyone loves being, and I think part of this is about the shift, like the media focus in through the pandemic in the last few years is as people have more insular lives and individuated lifestyles, mm-hmm. Media is becoming primarily about entertainment, you know, and it's going back to this like pull rather than push pull and with Zoom fatigue and all this kind of thing. I'm finding anyway that like people want to be entertained. They want content. They want to interface with your brand in a kind of on-demand fashion. Mm-hmm. But then that's very difficult to turn into, you know, the purchase, the call to action.
Yeah.
Like every time we send out an email newsletter, it's really interesting. It behooves me to understand this unless it's some bot thing in some like email program.
Yeah.
But I get like, I don't know, about 500 people clicking on my Calendly link to book time with me.
Huh.
But they never do it.
Hmm.
So I'm just going to start calling all of you if you're listening to this and just be like, what's up? You want to talk? Like, let's talk, you know?
User research is the only way to get,
honestly,
get
it's really,
to the heart of it.
Really interesting.
And I think, so you hear so much of this in sort of like social media discussion in the marketing community or the sales community. It's like, oh, email marketing is impossible now and clicks are, and it's, there's a lot of complaining.
Yeah.
And I think smart companies, like everything, look at this as an opportunity.
Right.
Okay. These things are all now particularly challenged, but I'm a big Ryan Holiday guy. The obstacle is the way. Like the fact that those things are hard now is a signal for smart companies to find new ways. And so the companies that are anti-fragile and understand, it's like, okay, great. All of my competitors will now struggle to mm-hmm. generate demand. Mm-hmm. If I can uniquely find new ways to do it, and instead of complaining on social media about how deliverability rates are going down, I now figure out new ways and means of driving pipeline, we'll win. Like all of these challenges I look at and I'm excited about because I think I can outcompete.
I think it's interesting too, because especially sitting on the side of like B2B, even if your end consumer is a business, is a small business, mm-hmm. right? What I find is curious about the sales problem, especially for B2B sales and two-way B2B sales, is that like in the sense of if each business is a B2B model,
yeah,
is that you're both facing the same problems,
mm-hmm.
right? So if you can connect the value between you, then it's like, great, it works.
Yeah.
No one wants to be sold to if they're not looking to buy.
Yeah.
And that goes two ways. So it is an interesting time because everyone's looking for solutions. So again, this is where I have that gripe, you know, off camera. I was talking about the lack of partnership formation in Canada.
Yeah, yeah.
And I have this running narrative, which I'll just repeat myself on camera again for, is in Canada, I'm increasingly noticing. I never noticed it as I was younger. And also I lived away from Canada for many years. But being an adult in business now and in a B2B environment, I'm kind of surprised at the depths to which monopolistic, you know, business culture has kind of pervaded the subconscious of entrepreneurs in this country, where like people are taking cues for their growth story and for the future and of their company and how they run their company from monopolistic enterprises that own an industry that have a moat so big and deep that you can't emulate them and you shouldn't grow towards them, you know?
Yeah.
And I think that's problematic. It's definitely something that like, you know, I think has a direct relationship to the entrepreneurial mindset, the source for education for the entrepreneurial mindset in Canada. So we were talking about like accelerators and incubators. And mm-hmm. if the people in those institutions are kind of, I don't know, if they're not teaching this method of fluidity and, like, you know, moving around obstacles, mm-hmm. and almost ignoring obstacles and only being solution mindset, right? If we don't have that, we're suddenly a very small community in Canada with, you know, a large land mass and hardly any people. And it's like, why am I doing business here?
Yeah.
Which feeds that rhetoric that people have had, with, you know, all the outcry with this whole, I don't know, what is it called? This whole
capital gains things,
right? And like Linkedin, anyone making over $250,000 on LinkedIn is freaking out, right? And you have these like corporate executives in real estate companies that are like, you know, burning everything to the ground on LinkedIn. And it's like, okay, get engaged, dude. Go help out the politicians, man.
Yeah. You
know, or whoever.
You're starting to see that now. People are definitely much more engaged than they ever have been. Yeah, I don't follow Canadian politics all that closely. I try to focus on building my business.
Right.
But I think that's a symptom of this greater concern that permeates the Canadian psyche, for sure. You know, it's like our greatest entrepreneur wasn't born here, like mm-hmm. Toby.
Is he our greatest entrepreneur?
Yeah, it's by far the biggest market cap company or software company that's been started here in the last, I don't know, 20, 30 years.
Yeah. And at the same time, look at it also as the customers of that company, right?
Yeah.
The way I look at it is that, like, if you can stand on your own 2 feet as an entrepreneur, leave aside like scale growth, mm-hmm. and you can do your own thing.
Yeah.
Right. And you can breathe to figure out what your destiny would be because you're making profit. Pat yourself on the back.
Yeah.
That's fantastic. We need a million more of you in Canada. Mm-hmm. Right. And then we can figure out scale. Everything doesn't need to be super scaled quick.
Yeah.
You know, and the Tobys can't, in my mind, be held on, for entrepreneurs getting started who are listening to this or watching this, can't be held on a pedestal. Like, I don't believe in the, I don't know. Personally, I don't believe in the totemization of billionaires. Mm. I just don't believe in it. I think it's kind of corrosive.
Yeah.
Because the truth is, like, it would be brilliant if we had like a billion millionaires that were cool with shit.
Yeah.
You know, rather than like 20 billionaires and everyone's just trying to be a billionaire and feeling like their life sucks shit, you know?
I don't look up to him or put him on a pedestal because he's a billionaire. I think it's because he's built something incredibly impactful for the world, and especially because it helps entrepreneurs.
Yeah.
And you know, certainly now working for a Silicon Valley-based company and the prior years doing advisory for primarily U.S. companies, and mm-hmm. I'm involved in two U.S.-based venture capital funds, so I've had so much more exposure now. There's just like a very different wiring that
completely different wiring
that would be great to have some of in this country, and hopefully I can help to do that one day. I spoke to a bunch of people at Collision. I'm like, hey, if you have portfolio companies and you need revenue help, like, I'm always happy to do a talk or meet with founders, because I'm eager to give back to the Canadian market. But certainly this like stark difference. And even I was lucky enough to work at League. Mike doesn't have that problem. Mm-hmm. Like, he's thinking, he's always thought really big. He's probably an exception to the norm, but so much in Canada, we see $100 million exit, $200 million exit, $50 million exit. People, there's fewer entrepreneurs that are trying to go all of the way, mm-hmm. and are willing to take the risk, continued risk, to get there. Because, you know, for many companies, you get to the $50 million ARR mark, there's reinvention. You know,
you need to be a different type of company. Yeah.
New product lines, new markets, like they're that sort of S curve.
It's funny, right? Because, like, I don't know, I used to think this all the time back in the day, that, like, and I see it all over the world, right? That, like, people don't necessarily have those stop gaps. Like, I always feel like an outlier when I say dumb shit to people, or what seems like dumb shit is like, dude, if I pulled $1 million out of my business a year, or even $500,000 out of my business, and all I got to do all day long was solve problems, but I don't have to worry about my mortgage or where I'm going on holiday, I'd be a rock star with that, you know? Yeah. Like, I wouldn't stop at an exit. Why the hell would I exit?
Yeah.
Then I build it up for a couple of years. I got $5 million, $10 million in the bank. Fuck, I don't give a shit about anything at that point.
Yeah.
Then I'm just having fun, man. I'm in the sandbox, you know? I'm going to go for that $1 billion with my company. Yeah. Like, but I think that there's that interesting thing of, like, people being pulled back into, like, when they feel like... I think it's weird for entrepreneurs to have this in their mind, but, like, I think it's a validation problem in Canada in general. I'll just say it like this. People don't know where to find validation. We don't have a strong... Now, another side of our business, of course, is media production, right?
Yeah.
So we see this when we're talking to content creators and we're talking to publishing companies. In the media landscape in Canada right now, there aren't any strong brands. There are none. You even look at like a company, there's a couple of different things that I'm seeing, right? So one, new brand formation in media. No one knows what media is, so they don't know how to use it is the excuse that we hear. Building a Canadian audience is difficult because we're so geo-dispersed and we're likely to consume content that doesn't come from Canada.
Mm.
There's all these things. And then you look at the economics of it. You look at the strong media companies that should be like pumping out great shit.
Mm-hmm.
They're dying. Like the recent news last week, right, was this is weird because I don't do stock stuff, but yeah. I caught this story through stock information. There was a, there's a company called Corus Entertainment.
Mm-hmm.
Corus is a big company.
Yeah.
Storied company. It's grown very large. There's lots of different business units. It's pretty diversified. So you think that it's pretty hedged in as a revenue story. Their animation team has always been great. And I think they're the guys that do Paw Patrol, you know, there's property in their asset kind of portfolio.
I think Spin Master is Canadian as well.
Yeah. Spin Master's Canadian.
Yeah.
Maybe they're Paw Patrol. I don't know. I thought Nelvana animated it, but it's maybe owned by, by Spin Master. But the point is, like, their stock went down to 20 cents and it was like, okay, fire alarms ringing, right, for the investors and they're all dumping it and it's driving it further. Now, that's different than the actual balance sheet story, right? But $1.2 billion in annualized revenue and they can't hold on to $1. Last two quarters, they've lost something like 10% of their, you know, ARR depleted in one quarter and then down to 15%. So it's like plummeting like crazy.
Mm.
Now, again, they have their internal problems. You know, whoever's responsible for revenue and money needs to do a better job or whatever. But like what I'm finding...
It's always the money. It's always those sales guys at fault.
Yeah. Yeah, it's always the sales guys. They didn't bring in more revenue, right? It's always like we need to keep growing our revenue. Forget about the liabilities. They're a factor. You know,
don't worry about the product. Don't worry about the marketing. It's like, come on.
But like I look at it, I'm like, if you're bringing in $1.2 billion, you know, and you've got zero margin or negative margin, you should be able to have room to clean up the story. You should. But in the media landscape anyway, we don't have businesses that are healthy enough or motivated enough to create, I think, a pervasive Canadian narrative through their properties, through their actual content. So that's something interesting. But I look at like it's people are less motivated than ever to create media companies that own the IP, you know.
Yeah.
There's services companies that produce it for entertainment, for like Netflix, but...
Mm.
Yeah.
Yeah, I wonder, I don't want to default to, it's probably the government's fault, but how much of a bunch of these problems is the fact that we've got way too much government in everything? Like the media sector has so much government money and government intervention, and at what point do you let the free market take over? Like what point do you stop propping up the CBC like we do? And
I don't think that's actually a competitive thing, you know?
Like, yeah.
To be honest, really? You're going to watch some CBC stuff because it's subsidized?
I just find it causes a lack of self-reliance. And anytime you start monkeying with the free market dynamic, I think we've seen a history like the wrong things happen. It's all from a good place.
No, I get your point.
We want to make sure that Canadian content creators are supported and we don't lose that. But I don't think Canadian content creators need a bunch of government handouts and intervention and rules. Like we have incredible people here, especially the diversity in this country and the number of interesting experiences and opinions and people. Like, just look at the comedians that we've produced over the years. It's
our creative sector, in terms of like the number of Canadians that are creative and employed in creative industries, are like on par with the best in the world, if not like, you know, per capita better.
Yeah.
And it's very interesting. Like, we work with the Institute for Canadian Agencies, mm-hmm. the ICA. And this is one of their big things, is like, they're trying to take the Canadian brand globally and enable Canadian agencies to take on more projects globally. There's a number of reasons backing this, mm-hmm. but what they found is that per capita, like, our agency sector wins more awards in all the big, like this week, it's yeah. The Cannes Lions is going on.
Yeah.
Right? Per capita, we win more awards than any country in the world.
Hmm.
So we do good work mm-hmm. in the creative sector. And that's coming, typically that's private sector work, right?
Yeah.
But I agree with you that, like, I think for me, that my critique on the government side of this, and it plays into the social critique, and I think comes back to this, like, enablement factor of the subconscious for entrepreneurs and company builders, is that ultimately, if you look at the percentage of people that live in Canada that fall into the employable age bracket, mm-hmm. right? And then you look at like how much of that employment is taken up by government. It's quite a lot.
Yeah.
There's a lot. So that has two factors that I draw out as very important. One is the government is competing for labor,
mm-hmm.
but how it's competing is not as a private enterprise, which means recomp is great. Mm-hmm. And you know, if you want to do your best work, you can go to that company.
Yeah.
Right. And that challenges you and lets you, excel yeah. in your personal dominion and so on. Instead, it's a place to park yourself for the majority of government workers at all sectors, from mm-hmm. municipal up to federal. People think of a government job as steady Eddie.
Mm-hmm.
I can go on 25 years of mat leave and come back and my job's there for me. And yeah. they'll kick Buddy out of my seat, literally, and I will go into that seat and work that same job I worked 25 years ago.
Yeah.
And I think that that's a problem. I think that the fact that the Canadian population kind of thinks of government as this boring back office that doesn't perform anything, makes it innately non-fluid, non-reactive, and certainly not proactive. Like, no one assumes that government, forget about the prime minister and politics, but the actual employment layer
mm-hmm.
is capable of doing anything.
Yeah.
So we have this like 450,000 person employment chunk of bureaucrats
yeah.
that we don't trust to actually represent us or do work for us or help us, which mm-hmm. is the inverse of what should be. Even I believe in social spending, and I think that, you know, what we want is efficiencies with it.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
we want all those 400 people to be awesome at their job. That's all we want. I think it'd be brilliant if we had this massive government. That's okay. But they did wicked stuff, you know?
Yeah.
Then this country would be far outpacing any economy in the world.
Yeah.
And I think that that's maybe a pipe dream, you know, it'll never happen. But that, anyway, paints the picture for me of kind of like the reference points, you know, like if people starting companies today are looking at, you know, they're setting their expectations for growth based off of, you know, a mega corp that has a moat around it that they can't ever emulate. And then the alternative on the other side is this like government job question,
mm-hmm.
you know, like, so a government job almost represents what a job always kind of was in some ways for mm-hmm. a lot of people. Like yeah. I could hang my hat there and have a 20-year career.
Mm-hmm.
That's no longer the case.
Yeah.
Right. You're liable to get fired for any reason at any point. And people yeah. need to wake up to that reality, because the harshness is the economy is not stable.
Yeah.
And even if you look at like listed companies, their economics are poor.
Yeah.
That idea of like going public and riding it out for 50 years is like
yeah.
not happening, you know?
And I think people are coming to terms now after the last 24 months that jobs are not inherently stable. You know, we got out of this
right.
you know, monster bull run of over a decade.
Definitely.
And now
here in Ontario, especially, right? For like 20 years almost.
Yeah. Yeah. And then layoffs all over the place. And so now it's interesting. You're seeing sort of the opposite thing happening, especially in the Gen Z population, where folks are like, well, if I could get fired, then I'm not going to try.
Yeah.
I'm not going to put myself out there,
right,
and risk then getting laid off. I have this conversation a lot with young reps and people looking for career advice, or just in interviews, it comes up and you can tell that, you know, they've gotten laid off twice in the last 2 years and
they
were trying really hard. And now it's like, well, I want to work two different jobs full time and I want to have this side hustle and whatever. And my advice is always, trying really hard obviously won't guarantee you success.
Right.
There's a lot of other variables and there's a lot of luck, but not trying hard will guarantee that you're not going to be successful.
Right.
And so you need to continue to put yourself out there and, you know, like, yeah, bad things might happen. And that's sort of a part of life. You're always thinking in bets. You're always placing probabilistic bets on working really hard for a company that has a variety of potential outcomes.
Right.
And now I think that's one of the challenges that between the Great Resignation and now people having gone through waves of layoffs, that we're starting to battle with this mindset in the market a lot. I hear this from,
yeah,
we're lucky enough at Owner. We've got some brand equity and I have a hyper transparent hiring style. Like I send this video to candidates before I meet them. And part of the video is, okay, about Owner, about the role. And the last piece is like culture. Here's what we're about. Here's the good things. Awesome product, super smart people. But here are the things that aren't for everybody.
Yeah.
It's like, hey, we're not a work-life balance culture. Like, we're here to win. We're trying to build a winning company. And that means working really hard.
Yeah.
And that's not for everybody. And absolutely no shade. If you want to go find a 35 a week thing and you got other personal interests, that's awesome. And I'm happy for you. But like, that's not us.
Right.
And so it's, you know, we expect really hard work. And
it's important to communicate that, you know, because I think a lot of companies pussyfoot around this issue.
Yeah.
And they're like delicate about it.
Or they do the opposite.
Yeah.
They're like, oh yeah, we have great work-life balance. And then you get in and they're like, well, I didn't see your green dot on it at 5:15. And you're like, well, I thought we had work-life balance. you see this all the time because it's you know, you're trying to.
I'll catch up at 10 o'clock on my emails before I go to bed.
Yeah.
No, and, you
and,
won't.
Yeah. And it's fine to work 9 to 5. There is nothing wrong with it. It's just you have to be honest with yourself and honest as a company. Then, like, we might not achieve a certain type of outcome.
Right.
You might still build a great company. Maybe you just, the product is incredible.
Right.
And you made a bunch of really smart decisions and you're smarter than everybody. But most companies don't have that advantage. Most companies just have to work really hard to get to something great. And so it's, you know, like companies with a 4-day work week. It's like, I just fundamentally don't think that you can build a multi-billion-dollar outcome.
No.
Doing it. It's not
Hey,
never.
Unless you're a gold company or a raw material extraction company. You know what I mean? Like,
maybe.
If the means of generating income for your company, for the most part, is like an automated function.
Yeah.
Then it's different. But if you rely on like new business formation, new relationship formation, if you can't trust that your customers won't walk,
yeah,
then you got to put in work.
Yeah,
across the board. Yeah,
yeah. I mean, any profit, any massive profits, are somebody else's opportunity, and those profits will be competed away. And if you're working 4 days a week, and my team is working 5.5 days a week, like, I'm going to win, or like that, I'll bet on the 5.5 day a week company
right
every day. And yeah, oh, you can show me the research. Well, actually, no, people are more productive and da 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 da.
If people feel apathetic,
yeah,
then it just ruins everything. You know, like, it starts with that, like, man, that Friday was really nice that I took off. You know, I like this. I like this. I was at the beach. You were at the beach? Yeah, I was at the beach, you know. So good. I'm thinking in a couple of years, I'm going to move to the beach. I love the beach. And then it's like, damn, those 4 days really sucked. It's like, I would say this too, right? Like, the assumption that we're working in a natural, in this kind of like nature mandated structure, people kind of assume a lot of things that are wrong, you know, in urban reality and modern urban white collar reality, especially, right? Subconsciously, people see skyscrapers as trees. You know, there's all these studies to map the naturalistic perspective onto urban reality. But then there's this thing of the 5 day work week and the 9 to 5 culture, like that was fucking, you know, factory practice for Henry Ford, right? And it was all about resource optimization. That work week was created to enable the workers to have just enough rest and family time that they feel motivated to like do this to make a coil in a machine, you know? Yeah. And so like, is that the right culture? Well, there's two ways to answer that at least, but yeah, the common backlash to that is this four-day work week question of like, yeah, we work too much. But maybe you're working on the wrong things. And if you work on the right things, you might actually be motivated and it might fulfill you in your life. And you're like passionate about it and you love it and it's part of who you are. And that's not bad. That's cool.
Yeah. There's a book I love called The Happiness Hypothesis by Jonathan Haidt. And he talks a lot about finding meaningful work. And
right.
Like what is work that you find to be fulfilling? And a lot of that is being in service of others, I find. You know, we're tribal by nature. The reason we dominate the planet is because of our ability to work with one another. If you go back to any of the Yuval Harari stuff. And so how do you, as a leader or as an entrepreneur, build an environment where people feel like they can be fulfilled by their work and they feel like they're making an impact, especially in service of others?
Right.
That's coming back to this engagement stuff. Like, why does mission matter so much? I think mission matters a lot because people want to make an impact on the world around them and other people, other humans. And if you can help people do that, then like 40 hours or 50 hours a week doesn't have to feel like it's hard or bad. Like I work a lot more than that. And I am itching to sort of work more sometimes because I'm genuinely excited about what I'm doing, mostly because my job is about service, not just our customers, but to my team. Like the thing that I care the most about more than anything is growth. And I have the saying, like, growth is always the answer. And so if I can be helping my young reps establish their sales career and learn the fundamental skills that they'll take with them the rest of their lives and give them their first account executive job or manager job and give them a platform to grow, there's honestly nothing more fulfilling than that. My single favorite part of my job is getting to tell people that they're getting promoted. And even when we promote reps, so it's like multiple levels under me, as soon as that happens, I call that person or I hop on a video because I want to congratulate them because it's just the best thing. And I think the reason it feels good for me personally is because it comes from that place of service and it comes from a place of like truly helping somebody else. And the more that I think a leader can think of their role in this servant leadership mentality and find ways to serve their employees and instead of seeing them as like cogs in this wheel that they're trying to find ways around and manipulate, it transforms your relationship with those people, your fulfillment from work, and those people's fulfillment and engagement. I truly think I have these leadership values. That's number one.
Yeah.
Servant leadership is number one. Growth is number two. Transparency and authenticity is number three. And if you can operate from service, like all of a sudden, like work feels like pretty meaningful.
Yeah, totally.
You find your icky guy.
Yeah, I was just going to say that word.
Yeah, yeah.
No, honestly, I'm always like picking up little bits of trash on the floor. Yeah, like whatever you can do, right? You apply yourself.
Yeah.
And applying yourself is in itself fulfilling.
Yeah.
But you have to have that ownership of ego and ability to be aware in order to even, I think, connect with what fulfillment is. You know, and I think that's an interesting thing when you're hiring, especially, right? Looking at talent. it's there's lots, I think, under the hood about, like, you know, psychology and the makeup of people that you need to size up when assessing someone's ability to perform and, mm-hmm. And apply themselves.
That's a huge part of my hiring framework.
Right.
Yeah. And especially, you know, we're selling SMB, and so hiring earlier career folks. And so you don't have a big long track record of multiple years of work experience to validate. And sometimes I'm hiring people who have never done sales before.
Yeah, because who's a salesperson? How do you even hire someone with track record? I feel like...
Yeah. And so for us, it's probably 60 to 70% of our hiring framework is DNA. What are the raw building blocks of that person? Are they driven, curious? Do they like to learn? Do they enjoy effort? Mm-hmm. Do they enjoy a challenge? Do they fundamentally have a growth mindset?
Right.
Do they see hard things as an opportunity to get better? Or do they see hard things as trauma? Mm-hmm. Do they see... There's really cool work by Dr. Aaliyah Crum out of the Stanford Mind-Body Lab. And she talks about there's two types of people. People who view stress as enhancing or stress as debilitating.
Yeah.
And if people are of the stress as enhancing mindset, when things get more difficult, they get more focused.
And lean into it
versus the opposite. And so I'm really trying to find people with this raw DNA that then I can teach both the work and life skills.
Right.
To be successful. And if they have a track record of success in sales, great. But if it's like I was the number one tuba player in my town, or I was a valedictorian or whatever it might be, I want to see a history of success. I want to see an understanding of how to learn and an enthusiasm to learn, mm-hmm. a curiosity. And if you can find those things, companies who have invested in growth systems, like, sky's the limit. You can build an incredible organization, but there's so much bad leadership out there.
There is.
I think a lot of the root cause is they don't go do, most of the bad leaders don't go do the work to learn about what good leadership is. And again, I sometimes sound like a broken record. Like, growth is the answer.
Right.
Like, just go learn it. I was horrible at managing remote. I had no clue. I started reading about how to manage remote teams. It's like, oh, wow. Okay, so all the stuff, just do the opposite of what I was doing. That's the answer. And you can figure it out. Now we're pretty good at it.
Yeah, it's interesting. And I think also there's something just to ask you about. You mentioned that you own like sales and customer support, right? Like anything that touches the customer.
Yeah, yeah.
What can you say about that, the integrative kind of approach to owning the customer relationship and how sales maybe can be a bit humanized because of not being abstracted from that customer story and lived experience?
So highly impactful for us.
Right.
For sure. These two teams lived separately for about my first year at the company. And then I brought over the customer onboarding function. And within weeks, it's like all of a sudden things were getting better because now, like, one, it's all my problem now. And I was trying to be a good partner for that side of the business. I cared about post sales because I'm trying to build a company, like, just setting up hollow close wins doesn't really matter.
Right.
But it's different than owning it and having all of those managers in now one set of manager Slack channels, management rhythms. They all adopted my sort of weekly updating and reporting cadence. So I think having a single threaded ownership is really impactful. I think having alignment across those teams helps a lot. But it doesn't work. In a lot of cases, it doesn't work because you can't get the sales leader to care about the other things.
Yeah.
And so somehow you have to get them to care and as an executive, put as much pressure on that revenue leader for the post-sales stuff as you do sales. Because oftentimes the CEO, you know, will nest CS under the sales leader, revenue leader, but then still only talk about the new bookings number.
Exactly.
And really be pushing there. So I believe that having a full stack model makes a ton of sense. That was my team at Shopify was full stack from sales all the way through to post sales. And it's definitely helped us drive better customer outcomes, lower churn, at owner.
Yeah, I mean, that's the ultimate goal. I think it's funny because in early stage, a lot of companies, especially if they're locked into funding cycles, you know,
mm-hmm.
seed to series A, it's like get them in the door to prove to who? Not them, not the customers, but prove to the investors that you're growing.
Yeah.
Retention, okay, well, maybe there's bugs in the software and that's why they churn. We'll figure it out later.
Yeah.
And then you're just like trying to get to the next thing and the back door's open and everyone's running out.
You have to elevate those metrics to the same level of importance as the sales metrics. That's where a lot of companies struggle is they spend too much time talking about sales. Those are the numbers that you put on all the dashboards that you mention at town hall. And so bringing CS to a prominence alongside sales is important. The other thing, interestingly enough, is you just have to spend money on that function.
Yeah.
And again, sales. So my sales org, I had a RevOps director and one, then two people on his team. Mm-hmm. And the CS function, we did some stuff for them, but like had no similar function. And so when we brought over onboarding and then CS, I said to Steve, who runs that function, I'm like, hey, I need you to spend more than 60% of your time there. It's like sales is fine. Just let it go. And I need you to try to stay out of, like, don't get pulled into their stuff.
Yep.
Because that function will keep humming. But like 60% of your time needs to be here, 40% on everything else. Mm-hmm. And wouldn't you know, within weeks, it's like, okay, our ticketing system was all broken and things weren't flowing from one team to another. Okay, that gets resolved. Mm-hmm. And then we get the reporting improved. And now all of these metrics start ticking up every single week. And it's because of that RevOps and enablement investment.
Right.
But I don't know why. I mean, I do know why, because everybody needs new revenue. And so all the resources float there. But I think if companies could just spend more dollars on systems instead of people, CS would function a lot better. Because routinely I look at what CS teams are doing. I was like, oh man, like you're doing that on a spreadsheet. I was like, you don't have any automations for that. You're doing all of that manually.
Right.
And in, you know, my sales team, we've got automations through AI running across call transcripts to automatically update CRM and automated stage changes. And like we're trying to.
We do all that manually.
Yeah.
Although I don't have that many customers, but it's like it's also about your tool set, right? And it's like a lot of the times people don't pre-architect or strategically architect their stack to support their sales and CS functions. They're kind of like, we'll procure a tool. So we got the CRM. We didn't go with Salesforce because who has money and time to build what we want out of it, right? And then, okay, we got this thing. Ah, they don't have integrations. We'll use Zapier. Okay, Zapier will kind of like, it's not a two-way sync. Yeah. Oh, no, data synchronicity. Once a week, someone will go in and check the data, make sure it's okay.
Yeah.
Then you got this, you know, so, and then the hindsight, you know, perspective or the review down the line is always like, okay, well, if we want to rebuild our stack, then that's a whole thing.
This comes back to being able to operate at two levels of abstraction at the same time and understand that, okay, so I hired Steve when we were, I don't know, less than 10 million ARR, maybe 5 million ARR. And same thing with enablement. But if I project ahead, okay, where's this business going to be in 12 months? Like we need a lot of systems and infrastructure. Everything's going to fall apart. And so we spent the money ahead and hired people that were more senior than you would typically at that stage.
Yeah.
Knowing that if we're confident in our growth trajectory and I'm confident I can get to this place in 12 months, just spend the money now.
Right.
Like what is it in terms of burn on a monthly basis in addition to your current rate? It's a drop in the bucket, but it feels like it's like, man, you're going to have a director for enablement and another director for RevOps for like an 8-person sales team. Mm-hmm. Like that seems crazy. Well, for an 8-person sales team. Yeah. But for a 25-person sales team for a $25 million ARR business, that's easy. And those investments get you to those places faster. It lets you make better decisions.
That's also about this like capital prudence, you know, for companies that are raising money.
And it's penny-wise, pound-foolish is oftentimes what happens.
But that's what the capital is for. If you're raising capital, it's to be a function in enabling your growth. Mm-hmm. Like, some people don't necessarily get that, you know, especially like product development companies, companies that are product development companies and not product reliant companies.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, and so then it's like too much investment on engineering and building functions and then like making something for the whole world to use when only a quarter of the world would use it, you know?
Yeah.
And there's rabbit holes everywhere with software.
Yeah. Yeah. It's tough. But I think in this age of AI, we're going into hopefully those investments are a little easier to make now because there's tooling that can do so much more.
Yep.
But we'll see. It's a problem exciting. To see all the time.
It's an exciting era.
Mm-hmm.
Lastly, we didn't talk much about kind of the product and about the customers.
Yeah.
So owner today.
You can think of it like Shopify plus HubSpot for little tiny restaurants. Takeout restaurants.
So it's e-com.
Yeah. So website, online ordering.
Yep.
So you can transact. Email and text message marketing. Custom branded app. So you could have a Kyle's Pizza app of your own, and every customer has one. Loyalty program, all of this stuff wrapped into one solution, and it's basically pre-done for the customer.
Wow.
The big difference between us and our competitors is we give a lot less customization. So you can't have as much control over an owner website as you can our direct competitors. Mm-hmm. But in exchange, you get performance. Because restaurant owners, not digital marketers by nature. And digital marketing is like counterintuitive in many ways. Mm-hmm. And because we restrict the number of choices we give to the restaurant, it means we know we're doing the right things for search engine optimization, for conversion rate optimization. And as we're testing things in small cohorts of customers, like, oh, that was really successful. This new checkout flow has increased conversion rates by X, then we can just deploy that across the entire customer base.
Right.
So typically when we move customers over from our direct competitors, we see them pop like 50, 100% in terms of the direct delivery volume.
Wow.
Because we have this opinionated stance as a product. And so we explain this to customers. Hey, yeah. If you want all the control, you want all the knobs and dials, bells and whistles, like here, go with
right. Not the right thing.
Yeah. But if you want to set it and forget it, then
and that's choice. Everyone, I would assume, wants to set it and forget it, especially if like...
Most.
Yeah, they're involved in operations. If it's like a hospitality group that owns like 20 restaurants.
Yeah.
And they're like, oh, but we just hired Phil, you know?
Can we get custom fonts? No. Right. Absolutely, you cannot do custom fonts.
It's interesting.
Yeah. And so there's a fit. And some restaurants have a very opinionated stance on how they want their brand to look. And that's okay. And we will happily direct them to the right fit for them.
Yeah.
But, you know, we sell through this radically transparent style where in the first couple minutes of a call, we're explaining this is where we're good and this is where we're not good. Mm-hmm. And I think so. Owner is actually the highest rated software company in all of restaurant tech, not just in our competitive set, but on G2, there's no other restaurant tech company that has higher ratings than us. And that is because one, the product's awesome. It generates great results, but also we're only encouraging the right customers to opt in.
Yeah. And that focus is super important also for your responsibilities, right? For sales and customer retention.
Yeah.
Really drilling down on like who the customer should be.
And for product,
right?
Because we can build with this worldview in mind, and they don't need to compromise, or they don't get pulled in other directions by customers that are, you know, a little off fit. So it does really well for us. The customer base is you know that mom and pop takeout and delivery concept that's trying to win online and find new customers.
Also, is there a marketing function, like paid marketing function into this?
No, because that doesn't really work for mom and pops.
Right.
The clicks are too expensive. So we've run pilots to see. We have an incredible demand gen leader.
That's an interesting insight, though, so for anyone listening to this.
Yeah.
The idea of like, you know, because a lot of people have different types of retail businesses, right? And the question of like, how expensive is it to bring people to your store?
Yeah. Apparently. The ROAS, the return on ad spend is just almost impossible to justify it. maybe we figure that out. And if we do, it would be incredibly impactful. But for most, the research would show that most restaurants generate almost all of their new customers through search engine marketing, just like getting found, and then word of mouth. Even social media, like a lot of the big restaurant marketing gurus be like, oh, get your social media, post every day, this and that. No one finds new restaurants through social media.
They don't.
Very, very few. There's exceptions.
I was trying to tell someone, I was telling someone in a gym business earlier this week. I was like, there's this assumption for a lot of people that consume a lot of social media that like, hey, here's where all the people are. This is where all the people are. But for the most part, at least like TikTok and Instagram, that's push media.
Yeah.
No one's searching on those platforms.
No.
YouTube is maybe different, but
it's
then
an
what's
entertainment.
Your, and YouTube, you could create a show for the Neapolitan pizza chef guy who, you know, maybe gets some traction, but even then,
it's
how
not,
do you target the geo?
It's not your geo. Yeah. Exactly. And there are ways to use social media intelligently. Like if you're a gym business, the entire thing should be filming your students, tagging them so that they want to share it and look cool on their profile, and then their friends see them.
Right. That's there. Where you're training. Oh,
that's
okay.
That's a great strategy. But just running social media ads for gyms might make a lot more sense because the ticket size is way higher.
Right.
You know, it's $150 a month. The LTV is in the thousands. Okay. That might make more sense to do pay-per-click marketing. But for a takeout and delivery heavy concept that has an average ticket price of $45 and a gross margin of $10,
right,
you're going to generate enough clicks at a 10%. Well, owner sites are 10%. The average is 2%. Mm. So if you have an average website, you're going to drive enough traffic at a 2% conversion rate to pay back a 10% gross margin.
Yeah, it doesn't add up.
There's no way. Even if that person comes back, you know, for months and months and months, it's hard to justify it. So that's why we're all in on SEO. We've like made that a huge part of our platform, and that's where we win.
Real quick, all the kind of changes to Google in the last year, is that worrisome or that's all hype? Like Google's still Google. People still need to search for stuff. Helpful content updates and so on aren't going to freak out the algo to not work properly, is it?
Again, the obstacle is the way, and Google will always change. People have been freaking out about algorithm changes since Google started to be a thing.
Right.
And smart companies will figure out how it works today and they'll keep winning. And if you keep doing the same things, it's not going to be great.
And at least customers on owner don't need to own that responsibility. They're like, you guys are going to figure it out for us.
Exactly. And we hired one of the preeminent SEO experts in the world. He built SEO products for SEO people. And he was on contract with us and joined full time. And so we are focused as a company. And if that is a competitive advantage, we're like, well, let's just go get one of the best people in the world for this thing.
That's great.
And so we're figuring that out pretty rapidly. And so for us, it's great.
Mm-hmm.
We want the algorithm to change as much as possible and be as
you can react to it.
As chaotic as possible, because we think we can react faster.
Interesting perspective.
Mm-hmm. Anti-fragility, that's business.
It's so true, right? Yeah, especially in a post-pandemic reality. I keep talking to Toronto-based business people about this, is that like, look, we were locked down for a long time. People don't realize how it affected their brain, you know?
Yeah.
And they're kind of like, I can't deal with more change. Life has changed.
Yeah, yeah.
You know?
Change. There's an incredible book called Master of Change by Brad Stolberg that I would encourage everybody to go read. If you're good with change already, you'll love it. If you're not good with change, definitely read it. Because it is... everything. The world will only change at an increasingly rapid pace.
Mm-hmm.
There's only one
constant, and that is change.
And if you look at the sort of pace of change over time, it's compressing. And now with AI, it's like, oh my Lord, where is this thing going to be in 2 years?
Yeah.
So if you want to have a successful career in life, I would say mastering change is probably a good skill set to master.
Totally. Thanks for taking time.
Yeah,
it was awesome to chat.
Yeah.
I think you dropped some gems you know, that are going to be insightful for a lot of our audience, and also a reading list. So for anyone who heard those titles fly by as you're watching or listening, we'll put that in the show notes so that you could see the kind of 3, 4, or 5 books that Kyle recommended reading. And maybe there's a couple that you want to add to the list.
I have a reading list on my LinkedIn as well.
We'll link to that.
So it's one of the featured things. So yeah, find me there, and I'm always dishing out recommendations and random stuff.
Nice. Thanks for coming on, man.
Appreciate the invite. This is fun.